Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 15th, 2019. My talk and our Sangha discussion introduces the 12-week Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. And appropriate to the beginning of our Dhamma study is a talk on the Bhadakarata Sutta, a sutta on what it means to have an auspicious day. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So, you know, a little background on the book. I think I mentioned it on Saturday. The Truth of Happiness was actually meant to be my second book on Buddhism, but I don't know how many years ago now, maybe 6 years. I was asked to put together an 8-week course for 100 and integrative medicine to start that, to kind of kick off their mindfulness program down there. And so I put this together and then decided to add on to it a little bit and just publish it as a book before Becoming Buddha. But it was always meant to be a study guide to the bigger volume, to Becoming Buddha. But it's worked out pretty nicely. I think probably three or four times we've been through it here as a Sangha. And it really does work well as a very broad but very effective foundation to introduce and establish the Buddha's Dhamma. So next week you'll read and hopefully come up with maybe a couple of questions or comments. At the end of each chapter, there's instructions for doing a little bit of homework if you want. You don't have to write it, but bring it back to class. We can have a discussion on it. So the Buddha taught meditation for one primary purpose, and that's to deepen concentration. The meditation method that I refer to and a few others that the Buddha taught is shamatha vipassana meditation. The Buddha never used those words. It's simply, you know, two old Pali words that describe what his meditation method does. When the Buddha taught meditation, he simply used the word jhana, concentration. He would say, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana. And everybody knew what that meant. Go do a practice that deepens your concentration. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. Despite what the modern insight movement has done, the Buddha teaches, and I think in the Truth of Happiness book, I mentioned the Yoganatha Sutta in there. In that sutta and many others, the Buddha teaches that these two components of meditation, shamatha, quieting the mind, developing a tranquil mind by being mindful of the breath, leading to insight, are two components of a successful meditation practice. In other words, it's not just meditation. It's not just being mindful of the breath. It's using mindfulness of the breath to deepen concentration, to gain insight, and then from the context of the rest of the Buddha's Dhamma, it's a very specific insight into the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of self, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering that results from not understanding the first two. So again, very specific insight into three marks of existence. The reason why I say that is a lot of modern meditation practices, but even during the Buddhist time, meditation was taught more of a way of just wandering around in the contents of whatever's occurring in your mind. In fact, it's often taught that way. Whatever's occurring, just think about that and put your mindfulness on your thoughts. Well, that's just meditative distraction, isn't it? Put your mind, when you find you're caught up in your thoughts, you come back to your breath, as the Buddha teaches. And it is mostly off our cushion as we integrate the Eightfold Path and we understand the proper application of refined mindfulness that we are able to develop insight into the three marks of existence. So insight may occur on our meditation cushions, but usually it's the insight that we developed into the three marks of existence is so subtle that we hardly ever notice it, except along the way we'll probably have some aha moments too. I can think of a few of those that were very significant. But most of it is what we come back into class and we talk about, this happened and I realized that, and this occurred, and I brought this part of the practice into it. That's how we integrate the Dhamma. That's one of the reasons why we talk a lot here. I've had people come to class and say, I'm not coming back because you talk too much. Well, it's a necessary component, I think, of a well-focused Sangha to discuss how we're integrating the Dhamma in that way. Along the way in this course, we're going to learn what the Buddha meant by four foundations of mindfulness. We'll go over the Satipatthana Sutta. I may try to squeeze in the Anapanasati Sutta, maybe not. We'll cover dependent origination, what the Buddha awakened to, that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. So the Buddha taught to gain an understanding of these Four Noble Truths. And it's the significant difference. That's the significant difference between what the Buddha taught and most every other salvific religion. The Buddha never saw himself as a savior. He didn't try to teach a salvific religion. He simply taught a framework for us to understand what's going on moment by moment. To understand ourselves, what actually constitutes a person in relation to the environment that we're living in. And how to live in with that understanding in peace and happiness no matter what occurs. He found a way to take the me out of the experience, the personalization, the stress-inducing aspect of that. I need this, I need that. Because he realized that the self, and I'm going to touch on it a little bit in the Bhadhakarata Sutta, in the way that we look at it, has no substance. It's always changing, always. It's not changing a little bit, like if I can get a handle on what happened 5 minutes ago, I can understand myself now. You can't. Because you're out of your body and you're stuck in 5 minutes ago. And if I think I'm going to do a lot of good things, like meditate a lot, and 2 weeks from now, after all that meditation, then I'll be good to go, you blew it again. None of that's going to work. Because it's taking your view of yourself outside of what's occurring right now. What's occurring right now? What are we doing right now? We're at a Dhamma class. We're learning something important. The best way to learn this is to first find a great teacher and then be present for what that person is teaching. That makes sense, doesn't it? But if you're sitting here thinking that it is by grace alone, in other words, you're going through the motions and something's going to be bestowed on you because you're going through the motions, you missed the whole point. There's nothing to be bestowed on any of us. But we can gain control of our thinking. We can think what we want to think, when we want to think it, when it's appropriate to think, without taking anything personal. We can be at peace no matter what occurs in the world. And then our life takes on a whole new level of meaning. And it's simply because we're here for it. We're here for our life as our life occurs. That's its reward. Any questions about that introduction? Okay. So the Bhadhakarata Sutta is just so appropriate for starting this study. It's one of the suttas that I squeeze in at the beginning, usually Friday morning, but sometimes at other times during our retreat. And it follows in this series that we've been doing, mentioned it to Matt earlier today. As a Sangha, we've really covered some remarkable ground this past year because we're all ready to understand it. And this follows along all what we've been talking about, the proper use of meditation, avoiding establishing the self in speculative and non-physical realms, what constitutes a person, those six properties. And then even last week, the fabrications that lead to five clinging aggregates. Yuck! I keep hoping it's going to be impermanent and somehow it's going to get nice and... Thank you, Matt. It's starting to turn my stomach. It might come back in.
Maybe a boat has been sharing it with you.
Not that one. Thank you.
Did you grab Bodhi's bottle by mistake?
No, but every now and then I do drink out of his bowl. Such a good dog. This subtlety of what it means about eye-making, this really is the heart of what we're getting at. It's the reason why we need a meditation practice that is just for concentration. because it is the constant preoccupation with establishing myself and every thought that occurs to me. That is, it is the constant distraction. And it's also the most difficult aspect because of this, what the Buddha talked about in the Nagara Sutta. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, prone to distraction, is always seeing itself and what's occurring from that point of view. In other words, we talked, the last week's sutta talked about the fabricating fabrications. We're constantly stuck in this way of looking at ourselves from a fabricated viewpoint. So how do you know what reality is if that's what you're looking at? You need the framework of an Eightfold Path that can only be integrated in a mind that has a measure of concentration. And then as concentration deepens, we're able to develop these more subtle aspects of eye-making. Everybody here gets that, right? You understand it. And you understand it because it's what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. You know, that saying, you know, that New Age saying we all kind of grew up with, know thyself. This is really it. You know, and there's nothing magical or mystical about thyself, except it's the most incredible thing in the world, isn't it? To know who you truly are. The Buddha was staying in Savatthi at Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, I will teach you the meaning of an auspicious day. Right immediately he gets after one of the most misleading aspects of the Dhamma about recollecting past lives or doing things to establish yourself in some comfortable Buddha heaven in the future. Do not chase after the past or project your thoughts to the future. Why? Because it means you're out of your body. And if you're out of your body, you're also out of your mind. Do not chase after the past or project your thoughts to the future. Not entangle with the world, be mindful only of what is occurring. Free of distraction, well concentrated, develop compassion informed by wisdom. The Buddha is also not so subtly insinuating that if you're not free of distraction and well concentrated, you cannot develop compassion informed by wisdom. You'll simply be too distracted by the need to be the most compassionate person in the world, and you'll forget the wisdom to go along with it. Mindfully engage with what is skillful. How do we know what is skillful? The Buddha taught us in the Magavabhanga Sutta and other suttas, what is skillful is integrating the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha teaches mindfulness, he says, recognize when you're in wrong view and enter and remain in right view. Be mindful of right view, etc., the rest of the Eightfold Path. This is a corollary to impermanence. The future is uncertain and death occurs equally for all. Remember Bahia. Those who remain mindfully engaged with life as life occurs throughout the day have had a truly auspicious day. A truly auspicious day, just being engaged with life as life occurs. And how does one avoid chasing after the past? One does not get carried away with the delight that in the past I had such a form, in the past I had such a feeling, in the past I had such a perception, in the past I had such a fabrication. In the past, I had such a consciousness, referencing the five clinging aggregates.
John?
Yes?
Is there any reason why it's always in that, that list is always in that that way? I mean, it's always form, feeling, perception, identification, consciousness.
I never thought about why it is that way, but I've never read it outside of that sequence, and I think it, because of the beginning with form, bringing what's occurring into this form is where all these other things are taking place, to understand that it is within this form that feelings arise, all
right.
Perceptions are acted upon, they're formed and acted upon, rooted in fabrications, and acted on and interpreted by consciousness. Now remember, all of that is rooted in ignorance of the way things are, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So the if you remember the sequence of dependent origination, from ignorance to fabrications, from fabrications to consciousness, from consciousness to name and form, nama rupa. Name and form is, I've identified, this is me. Mm. And once I've done that, once I've identified myself from a fabricated point of view, that this is me, excuse me, I am now compelled to to continue to defend and establish this self. And so from that initial ignorance, this is a wrong view I have of myself. But because it's the only view that I have, because my view is obscured by ignorance, a component of ignorance is to ignore, isn't it? But we're not ignoring some grand mystical teaching. I'm simply ignoring my own reality because my mind is distracted by my own ignorance. So again, the only way to extricate myself from that is to understand I've done it. But the great power is, when I recognize that, then I can do something about it. I don't need some external agency to act upon me. And I don't need to do anything all that terribly extraordinary. I just have to understand. And the understanding part is pretty simple.
The truth is in there. Oh, yeah. It really is. To create ignorance is burying what is really there.
Yes.
So there's something, the essence of truth is there. It's just the fabrications are there to somehow make it easier. And that's how you go through your life. You just, like, you will roll into your last moment fabricating if you don't gain the wisdom.
Yeah. And like we said last week in the sutta, we'll be continually just fabricating fabrications. And it does take, that's the essence of stress, isn't it, to keep this game going. It's not easy. I mean, the peaceful sage, as the Buddha described an awakened human being, is truly at peace because they're done trying to establish a self where a self can't be established. It's an impossible task, yet we all want to do it because we've all drunk the Kool-Aid. We all believe that this is what we should do. But the fact that the fact that the entire human experience is shrouded in ignorance is very difficult for people to accept that, just that notion in a general way. Yet that's what the Buddha awakened to. That's what set him apart from everyone that came before him that had an answer, and I would say that everyone that's come after. There's one gentleman that I would say sees this clearly, and that's Jiddu Krishnamurti. But the difference with him is he did not have a path to teach. He didn't understand it. He would reference the Buddha as an awakened human being because he studied it with Madame Blavatsky and a whole theosophical society, which he later rejected. But he didn't understand this part that the Buddha got about ignoring our own ignorance and how hard it is to overcome that. And that's the experience of five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates, they almost conspire against us recognizing who we truly are. So you brought up a good point. I hope I didn't make it more complicated for you. Yeah, your question was, are they always in that order? And I think I've never seen them outside that order. And I think because beginning with form, this is where all this has taken place. It's in this form, in a misunderstanding.
Remember, easiest to approach, too. I mean, you start at the form because it's in front of you.
It's where you are.
It's where you are.
And again, the Buddha didn't say there's no such thing as a form. And that in the I can't think of the name of it now, on the six properties, earth, fire, wind, liquid, space, and consciousness are the six properties that make up a human being, every human being. There's nothing special about those properties, is there? And so there's nothing special about what's occurring. Even within those properties, that someone with those ordinary properties was still able to understand it and awakened. That's what's extraordinary. And that's the potential that each and every one of us has to do just what he did by simply following what he figured out, to go from ignorance to wisdom. Okay. I had such a perception in the past. I had such a fabrication in the past. I had such a consciousness. This is called chasing after the past. And how does one not project their thoughts on the future? One does not get carried away with delight that in the future I might have such a form. In the future I may have such a feeling. In the future I might have such a perception. In the future I might have such a fabrication. In the future I might have such a consciousness. The Buddha is referring to the five clinging aggregates there again, not necessarily saying that we project each one of our fabrications into the future, but that's exactly what we're doing. And the five clinging aggregates, whether we're projecting them to the past or to the future, they're still fabricated. There's nothing there. It's not like we're a little bit off. Let's hang on to it. We're fabricating our own suffering. And so whether we do it in speculative realms or think that if I meditate for five more minutes, I'll be better. Not that we shouldn't meditate for longer periods of time. I'll be better once I get off my cushion. You still lost the point. I'm meditating not to be better, not to fix something. I'm meditating to deepen concentration. Why? So I can fully integrate the Eightfold Path and develop that refined mindfulness. So my mind isn't in the past or in the future, even in very subtle ways. And how does one become entangled with the world? An uninstructed, ordinary person, lacking understanding of the Dhamma, sees form as a self or the self as form. Confused, they see feeling as self or the self as possessing feeling. Confused, they see their perceptions as self or the self as possessing perceptions. Confused, they see their fabrications as the self or their self as fabrications. Confused, they see their consciousness as self or their self as the consciousness. And that's really getting to the heart of the matter, that last. It's really our thoughts that we continue to churn out, rooted in conditioned thinking, that we utilize to continue to establish a self rooted in ignorance. It's our thoughts. So ultimately, as we gain control of our thinking, we're able to recognize and abandon those fabricated thoughts. This is what is meant by becoming entangled with the world. And how is one not entangled with the world? A follower of the Dhamma, who is well-versed and well-trained in the Dhamma, does not see form as self or as a self possessing form. Pretty simple, isn't it? Can you all understand that? That not seeing your form, as possessing self, that is simply one of the properties?
Yeah. Isn't that why that's the first one?
Intellectually, that's fine, but to do that on a minute-to-minute basis is a whole different story.
Mm-hmm. Can you do it on an occasional basis?
Probably.
I would bet you all can. I mean, mm-hmm. Can you all do it on an occasional basis? Mm-hmm. Can you see that clearly? Can you see that?
Mm-hmm. You see it clearly, you see it clearly when you think of impermanence.
Yep.
Form impermanence.
Yep.
Feelings impermanence. And I catch myself that way. That when I'm believing it, I shouldn't believe it. It's impermanent. I know it. I kind of like flip it, you know?
Yeah. But if it's impermanent, how could it be you? How could it be yourself? I didn't hear what you said.
Isn't that why it's the first one? It's who I am.
Yep.
It has to be the first one. Everything of the mental factors are convincing you that this is who I am. I exist as this body. So that's what you're defending the whole time. You're defending that this isn't impermanent.
Yep. Yeah, and so understanding that I am, tricky when you start going down this road, but I am just these six properties. And what occurs to these six properties that is simply part of having a human life? Remember how the Buddha described suffering? Birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, age is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering, getting what you don't want is suffering. In short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. What's the Buddha's describing? An inescapable position that we can come to be at peace with by understanding it. But it's when I personalize it, when I'm getting sick or I'm getting old or I'm losing my eyesight, there's constant stress and I'm sticking the second arrow in. Or I didn't get the second piece of chocolate cake because it went to my sister. Or whatever, and you know, come down the whole list of disappointments that the grievances that we have with the world. It's like that, I was thinking of that Seinfeld episode where George's father has the festivus. And we have the airing of the grievances. That was his, that's his. But we do that all the time in our own minds, don't we? We air our grievances. What? How come I didn't get this? How come I didn't get that? All of that is just keeping this mass of ignorance churning from taking things personal. When all that we are those four elements, the space to, that holds it, and the thinking that directs it. And if I can take my thinking from wrong view to right view, rooted in concentration, I can free myself of all of that stress. And yet my life is exactly the same as it was before. Well, I mean, maybe not. I mean, it will likely change to some measure, but from the outside, you can't tell the difference. You know, you might look a little bit more peaceful. And that, it's getting back to this person composed of the same six properties as we did, figured it out, and he taught us how to do the same.
I went through a lot of physical discomfort over the weekend, and while I was doing that, I was trying to you know, disassociate from this misery, and it was not easy.
Yeah, it's when you're not feeling good, that's usually what you identify with, and you also kind of think that it's probably going to last forever. You're never going to feel good again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I know. Even if I get a cold, I feel that way. It's forever. But
and you need your sharpness of mind. If you know whatever is ailing you dulls your mind, it makes it harder to do that.
Oh yeah.
It requires a pretty sharp mind to stay at it and keep seeing how you identify yourself.
Yeah, because it's so distracting. But it also, it doesn't mean that we won't experience pain and suffering as we awaken. The Buddha described in the, one of these days I'll teach it, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the sutta on the last 90 days or so of his life. It's a long sutta. It describes it, the incredible pain he had from food poisoning. You know, he wasn't free of it, but he also didn't blame anybody for it. You know, it's just what occurred. Okay. Got to go back one. And how is one not entangled with the world? The follower of the Dhamma, who is well versed and well trained in the Dhamma, does not see form as self or the self as possessing form. With right view established, they don't see feelings as self or the self as possessing feelings. With right view established, they do not see perceptions as the self or the self as possessing perceptions. With right view established, they do not see fabrications as self or the self as possessing fabrications. With right view established, they do not see consciousness as the self or the self as possessing consciousness. That's, you know, imagine that we're not so enamored with our thinking that we don't take self-reference from our own thoughts. It's the ultimate freedom, though, isn't it? And I would bet that every one of you has had that happen, if not just occasionally, right? Not identifying with your thoughts. They're just thoughts flowing. That's the essence of a mind that is deepening in jhana, deepening in concentration. And it's the essence of a mind that can then avoid speculating about its existence, past and future, because it knows it's all the only thing that's occurring right now is what's occurring. There'd be no motivation or compulsion to even do it. To develop an auspicious day, remain present with your life as your life occurs. Do not chase the past or project your thoughts to the future. Remain free of entanglements with the world and mindful of what is occurring. Be mindful of impermanence and uncertainty. Those that do so will have an auspicious day. So says this peaceful sage. I love that last line. So says his peaceful sage. So I think that's a pretty good introduction to our Dhamma study. And it reinforces, what's the right word to do it? It frames our auspicious days within the Dhamma. It's important to recognize that the opportunity that we have to awaken is truly auspicious. One day after another, we have this opportunity. There's nothing more important that we can do for ourselves or for the people we love and the world around us. And we get to do it while we live our ordinary lives. We don't have to give anything up except ignorance is the point I'm trying to make. And so over the next 11, 12, 13 weeks, however long it takes us, we're going to deepen our understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma, like we have every year around this time. So, any questions about what I've talked about so far in this sutta? We'll go around the room. Okay. Matt, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. Good to be here. In framing this sutta with the five clinging aggregates, I think about what I always say is continuity obscures impermanence. Yep. And that continuity is the experience of five clinging aggregates. It's the self rooted in ignorance, referencing its own self through form, referencing its own self through feelings, referencing its own self through perceptions, fabrications, consciousness. All ignorant that death is something that happens to all of us. Impermanence is built into life. We none of us escape death. As he said in the beginning of the sutta, death is something that finds us all. So these six properties that make up form that is subject to death . That's right view. That's view that there is impermanence.
Yeah.
These six properties will expire.
Yeah.
What's clinging to these six properties is a view of self. How can I make this heap into a self that can survive, that can be great?
Forever.
Be forever, be great, be famous, be amazing. Yeah. You know? And then we suffer. Then we become disappointed.
Yeah.
So when I think about continuity obscures impermanence, when we think about impermanence, we can. It takes us back to what's actually occurring.
Yeah.
It's impermanent.
Yeah. Thank you. That and the five clinging aggregates are the vehicle for continuity.
Yes.
Required in other words to us to continue in ignorance.
Yeah.
Requires that vehicle holding it together, and it's David said before, it creates, that's the stress.
Yeah.
Is trying to keep the lie going, but we don't want to do it. We think it's all there is of us, and if I can just figure out a way to live forever,
the stress
create
of
all kinds of fantasies about how that's possible. And by me insisting that I can live forever, I stop living at all. Because I'm not here anymore.
And then when you toss in, you have a family, and they're five aggregates. I mean, you are dealing with a lot of stuff. You are dealing with like a child that at some point will die. You know, so you're clinging on to these things that just aren't sustainable. So
and then we try to make
a better thing to do than is to live the faithful path.
Yeah.
Enter and remain in right view.
And we create so much stress for ourselves because we think that should make sense. Why are they acting that way? You know, they're acting that way because of their own ignorance. You know, I swear I got a couple of brothers that have seven or eight clinging aggregates.
Gotta
be careful with them. Just kidding.
Again, we come to class to, you know, to realize the teachings of the Buddha, but we have to go back home and sit in our cushions and start to the practice, and then throughout the day catch ourselves when we're wandering off the practice, I guess. But it's hard to, when you do catch yourself in wrong view, you thinking of forming yourself in your own thoughts, it's hard not to get hard on yourself. I frequently run into being hard on myself, which is kind of a very negative thing to do, because I'm obviously trying to be doing the right thing, otherwise I wouldn't be catching me thinking in the first place. So, but I think that's probably something I should change or try to work on, you know, that just everybody's like this. I'm working on it, I'm steadily working on it. And when I catch myself in wrong view, that's it. You know, I'm just in wrong view at that moment.
Yeah.
Put it behind you. And realize that the five clinging aggregates are all impermanent. You know, they all come and they all go, and it's just my way of thinking at that moment.
Yeah, thank you. It's important to remember that there's nothing to take personal about having a mind that is rooted in ignorance. The Buddha starts out with saying dukkha occurs. There's nothing personal about that. Individually or on a global, you know, view. And when we start judging ourselves harshly simply because we're engaged in Dhamma practice to awaken, that's an aspect of taking Dhamma practice too personal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going fast enough, or it's whatever it might be, or I'm just not getting it. Just continue.
Mm-hmm.
Continue even with a measure of dispassion as far as your development in the Dhamma, because the ending is assured as long as we keep doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me see... get Jane in here. Hey, Jane.
Hey, John.
There you are. How are you tonight?
Oh, wonderful. Great class.
I agree. Are you going along with the course with us?
Well, I have to confess I did not get the book yet.
Oh.
I will.
Okay.
I'll do my homework.
All right, yeah. So I'll talk about it before we're finished tonight about the homework. But
I do like the discussion on impermanence.
Yeah.
Because the more I accept impermanence and uncertainty, the more peace I'm finding, so.
Yeah, and it is, that's the way it is. Well, I'm glad you joined us tonight.
Thank you.
Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Nice to be here. Thanks for teaching this study again. Within the context of impermanence and what Matt was saying about continuity, it's you can sort of see the form aggregate is what experiences karma through continuity rather than through impermanence, because you know, views that might have been established in the past to, like we just said, preserve the self in such a way, or line yourself up in such a way, or set yourself up that this is the view you want to have of yourself in someday. And continuity is what we experience in this body, and we experience it every day. But if we're able to release those views that we built up we say hardened views, they become hardened, or, you know, I almost think of a whole other subject entirely, but, you know, just, it's like calcified, you know, these views are, they almost become like bones, you know, and they have to be shed. You have to shed this set of views that's become this body that experiences everything, pain, pleasure, disappointment. But it's still here, and it's still able to awaken. You're still able to have this discrete experience. So
yeah, Thank you. Yeah, no matter how calcified those conditioned thinking is, we can still awaken. There's nothing will stop us from that. That's a good way to put it too. A clinging conditioned mind is calcified. It's the essence of hanging on to something because I've thought about it. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here. But we do need that form and those feelings, because that's the only thing we have to get to awakening.
Yeah.
Again, being in pain and seeing my blood pressure spike all of a sudden, it's like, I do need to take care of this, because, without a functioning brain, this awakening thing ain't going to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's important to take care of the form too. It doesn't, It's part of that awakening process, isn't it?
Yeah.
Without self-identifying with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that actually it's a little easier if you're kind of in a little bit of a crisis. Somehow I found it not so difficult to not identify with it. Because I realized, okay, well, this is the body, better take care of it. And go on, discomfort or not.
Yeah.
But it does need to work for anybody to get to awaken. Unless you're one of the lucky ones that just pops there just before the cow gets there.
Thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. I like what Kevin said. I can relate to that. You feel like you took your entire life to get here, and then you learn, oh gosh, I've got to dismiss an awful lot of stuff that I brought with me on that path.
Mm-hmm.
But then once you begin the work, it's very, obviously very freeing, and lighter to travel around, and much more enjoyable. But I'm very grateful to be starting the class again, and sharing it with all of you. So thank you.
David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. Just think about what this practice brings. Teaches you to be gentle with yourself. It teaches you to be patient. It teaches you that while you gain this wisdom, to understand restraint. And what Kevin said is true. It's like you were saying something about bubbles, and it decalcifies, and you can inject bubbles to help someone with dementia, and it's just
It clears out the
plaque. Chips away the plaque.
Chips away the plaque. It chips away. It's just like this. The wisdom is chipping away at that, and it's a good way to think about it, because it's not instantaneous all the time. It's this path. It's a practice. Mm-hmm. So it's a good way to think about it.
Yeah, it is. Wow. Thank you. And it's entirely practical.
Effervescent Dhamma.
<That's it. Yeah. laughs>
What's in there? Buddha bubbles.
Buddha bubbles.
Busy.
Ingredient X.
Hey.
Just been
makes me bubbly awakening.
Yeah. Just been
that. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I like that somehow starting the Truth of Happiness study. After we've gone so far into the path of looking at different suttas and understanding each of the concepts deeper, coming back now, it's like being able to lift up and clarify even more. So the idea of saying, you know, to be with life as life occurs, obviously that's the whole thing, but all these other ways of applying this framework to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, when Ram was saying, you know, when you're in crisis gives you the opportunity, so the keep thinking that the Chinese character for crisis also means opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it gives us a chance to practice, and whether I can let go at the time, like sometimes I can see myself in it, and I know, like, you don't have to do it this way, you can, you know, it's like seeing it, it's like, so saying that idea about, like, letting light,
okay.
I like being with it as, yeah, to,
just like,
without having to, it's like having our response, or, and then I can then choose how I'm going to react.
Yeah.
And that's what wisdom brings you, though. You know, that you have that, you can either go either way, or multiple ways. You know? So the clarity gives you.
Yeah, as long as you first establish that framework,
right,
prior to whatever the crisis might be. It was the Buddha's existential crisis when he was 29, when he first left the palace grounds. It got him looking, seeking. And then 6 years later, it was another crisis of almost dying from his ascetic practices that got him to look at, well, this doesn't work. You know, those extreme examples of suffering were important to Siddhartha Gautama awakening too. You know, we do the same thing. It's and those moments, you know, the Buddha's experience in the town that day, and 6 years later, passing out and rolling into the river, certainly united his mind and his body in that moment, didn't it? And it got him to look at, I mean, this is how he developed the middle way, why he called it the middle way, from the extremes that he lived, that life as a prince in his father's kingdom, getting everything and anything he ever wanted, complete sensory indulgence, and then that life of severe asceticism, those two opposing views of wrong views, extreme views, that made him realize it's not those extreme views. And if you think about where those extreme views take you, they take you out of your body. It's a middle way that unites a mind in its body. And crisis is usually the path, whether it's an extreme crisis or it's simply the underlying disappointment in general with life that gnaws at some of us. It gets us looking for something different. There's got to be more to life. There's got to be a different way of looking at it because something just doesn't add up. I was talking to Matt earlier today. You know, I grew up in Berkeley Heights. I had a great family and et cetera, et cetera. But I was just miserable. But I wasn't miserable because of so much my environment. I was miserable because of what I was told my environment should be. And it was just disappointing. You know, that's just all of it was. Thank you. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. I see this as the idea of maintenance came up. While we were talking, while everyone was talking, and the idea that there's this precious recipe of you know, this precious path, but it does have to be maintained,
mm-hmm.
and it does have to be observed. And Ram was talking about how it is for you when you don't feel well, and John Kabat-Zinn does mindfulness-based practices where you become dispassionate about your pain and don't take it personally.
Yeah.
But that's the, as Lauren always says, that's kind of the tip of the sword, you know, when you're right there looking at pain and suffering in your own body, in your own self, that all these little moments of insight and understanding and practice can lead to a better experience when you are facing that tip of the arrow, that space. And it's the idea of practicing patience, even in the little moments, the traffic light in Pittstown that takes 4 minutes to turn green in the middle of the night. And you sit there, so you practice patience, you know. Or for me, now one of my favorite things is getting to an appointment and actually having time in the waiting room to wait. Or being in the supermarket and just being able to stand online for a few minutes and not have to be anywhere or do anything. So it's kind of things have sort of, small things have turned around in certain ways. I like being early because that gives me, if I get there early and they call me in early for an appointment, it's like, I got this reading material.
I don't get to wait.
Yeah,
now I have to do meditation. Now I have to get upset because I have to get up. No. But, you know, it's just all these little things, and I believe that all these little things will lead to somehow a better acceptance of the challenges in life as we, you know, age and decay. You know, it has to.
And they already have, though, haven't they, Liz, for you?
Aged and decayed? Getting there.
make that ongoing process much more.
Oh, it has.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, and it's just by being in your life as your life occurs.
Yeah.
It made me think about when I was in the delivery room with my second daughter, and Liz was there, and Dean was there. And it literally, at least my memory of it, was like I would be like, and then
she was
then,
going into labor.
Yeah.
And we
I thought that was obvious.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, and then it would stop, and then we'd be like, okay, so where were we? We would go into like hysterics, and people would stop in going, what's going on in here? Why is everybody laughing? And I'd be like, wait a minute. Okay, so then
it was truly like that. It was
we
a special
were laughing
day.
So hard.
Yeah. Excuse me while I breathe.
Thank you. Secret to happiness. Alan Watts was right, even though he got some things wrong. Be here now.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, thank you. It's always good to rehear these teachings.
Yeah.
You know, the knowledge gain for me and the insight gain, it's also impermanent. It goes away over time.
Yep.
And it's necessary to be reminded. So you just have to keep on keeping on by coming to the Sangha.
Yeah, thank you. That's such an important that we're not acquiring the Dhamma, you know. We're learning how to think correctly. That's really all it is. So. Great class. So you'll read the chapter, week one chapter on Shamatavipassana meditation, and if you want to jot anything down, you could to bring the class next week for our discussions. But they're always good. In the email, I'm going to cite another sutta that I'll read too, related to jhana, to you know, one of those that we did a few months ago, and we'll continue in that vein. So, I think you're going to all find it interesting how much you understand the material now, as opposed to when you first kind of went through it. So,
it's odd that there are no new people. To me, it's odd.
Yeah, it is. We had a couple. We had a couple last week, but they didn't come back. But that's okay. Yeah, it would have been a good time for new people to start. That's the way it is. I think that's it. Any other questions, comments? We'll finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.